All right, well, there are no puns in today's sermon. We had enough last Sunday to last us for a couple years, for a long time. I have never, ever given a pun, at least intentionally. I don't actually find them all that funny. John's not here. I told this to Paul Coupin afterwards, and he looked at me as though he felt sorry for me, as though I had been born blind and had never seen flowers or a sunrise or mountains and that sort of thing. I told him that my humor of choice is dry, caustic sarcasm. And he had only known me for a couple of days, but he was quick to say that I had developed that pretty well. But I'm no caustic sarcasm in today's message either, at least nothing planned, but hard to say what might come out spontaneously on something like this. All right, well, many in our church through the years have been involved in demonstrations in front of the abortion clinic. These demonstrations or activities can take on various forms, marching on the sidewalk, holding signs, sidewalk counseling, perhaps even a rescue sitting in front of the clinic doors and risking or even getting arrested, or maybe even just standing off to the side praying. In fact, prayer would actually be a common element in all of these. If you've ever been to the clinic on the day that they're doing abortions, you will know that it is a place where Christians pray and pray pretty intensely, sometimes corporately, sometimes privately. Prayer for the baby, certainly. Prayer also for the abortion-minded mothers. Prayer for the reversal of Roe v. Wade. Prayer that the culture of death in our nation would be replaced with a culture of life, and so on. Well, about 25 years ago, when these demonstrations were really heating up, a number of pro-life activists around the country claimed that our prayers did not go far enough. They argued that we should be praying that God would bring judgment upon the abortionists and his staff. This judgment would be of such that it would remove them from their business, making them unable to continue in their killing. It could be, for instance, a financial setback that would cause that, maybe a physical impairment, perhaps incarceration of some sort, or even loss of life. The particulars would be left up to God, but our job, it was argued, was to pray that judgment would come and would come swiftly. The reason was pretty simple. If there are no abortionists, there will be no abortions. Concern for innocent babies trumps any concern for the prosperity and happiness of an evil oppressor. Plus, because they shed the blood of the innocent, they should get what's coming to them anyway. It is a matter of justice. And the case was supported by prayers found in the prayer book of the Bible, the Psalms. There we find a number of passages where God is called upon to bring destruction upon the wicked. And so if this is how God's people prayed back then when combating evil, well, it follows that this is how we should pray today when combating evil. Such prayers are what we call imprecatory. The word comes from the verb imprecate, which means to invoke or call down evil or curses on someone or something. Now, on a side note here, before we get too far into all this, to sort of help illustrate things, one of the most common prayers ever prayed, especially by those who are not believers or religious at all, is an imprecatory prayer. It's very short. It consists of three words. There's a subject, a verb, and an object. Most people don't think of it as a prayer, but it really is. A guy is running late to an appointment, a very important appointment. He's all stressed out. He gets pulled over for speeding, and when he sees the flashing lights in his mirror, he calls upon God. You know, not to bless the situation, but to curse it. So next time you hear that pagan friend of yours curse, as in G-D it, you might say something like, "There you go, praying again, and I didn't think you believed in God." All right? Well, that whole thing's another subject for another time, which I hope to get into it further someday. But back to praying judgment upon abortionists, and for that matter, other evildoers, those who prosper in sex trafficking, drug pushers, corrupt politicians, those who swindle the life savings of the elderly, and terrorists, you know, the list goes on, like those who butt in line, especially them, you know. But you know, evildoers, you know, who not only get away with it, you know, seriously, evildoers who not only get away with it, but prosper from their wickedness. Certainly, there would be no question that we could pray that their efforts would be defeated, that the evil itself would stop. But what about praying for God to judge them, punish them, hurt them for what they have done and do? At this point, well, we might be a bit reluctant to go that far, but this is exactly what we find in the Psalms. And this, in particular, is where the contention lies. What do we do with these ancient prayers in the Old Testament that are quite harsh and ruthless? Prayers that call for unsparing violence against the wicked and against one's enemies, to crush them, and to do so without mercy. How do we reconcile those imprecatory prayers with the teachings of Jesus that call upon us to love and bless them? After all, on the cross, Jesus prayed, "Father, forgive them," not "Father, obliterate them." Well, recently, as you know, 21 Christians were beheaded by ISIS. And since then, about 250 more have been captured. Why not pray for God's judgment to wipe these wicked oppressors with his mighty hand of wrath, to wipe them out? There is something in us that wants to pray that way. And quite frankly, it doesn't really feel wrong to feel that. Well, I figured there was an easy explanation for all this, some general consensus out there among scholars and theologians and church leaders that would explain how those prayers in the Psalms are to be applied today or not applied, but there isn't. The question is actually an unsettled one. In fact, I've come across at least 7 or 8 different positions on this matter. But I believe that it is a question worth pursuing nonetheless. It is a very practical one. For instance, on Sunday mornings, you know, when we pray as a church body, to what degree can we call upon God to execute justice? We want the abortionist to stop, for instance, but is it wrong to want him to pay for what he has done? To pray that the thousands of babies he has killed would be avenged? Is that a wrong prayer? Are they not worth that? Just to use one example. And so, as promised in previous weeks, this is our next subject to tackle, imprecatory prayers, which we'll talk about today and next Sunday. And so here's the plan. We'll begin with a general survey of the Psalms. Our primary interest here will be to recognize that there are different types of Psalms and what those are and why that is important. And then we'll look at some of the imprecatory statements found in them. Before we can kick around the various theories on whether we should or shouldn't pray this way, we first need to get a good idea of what those prayers actually look like, why they are there, and what they mean. There are a number of these, and so we won't take time to look at all of them, just a sampling. And then we'll list out some observations from those passages. We'll only get through a couple of those today, and we'll have to finish that up next Sunday. Also for next Sunday, we'll spend some time on what is probably the harshest imprecatory prayer in the whole Bible. We want to work through that carefully, and then we'll be ready to consider the modern-day application. So let's get started. While Christians have always struggled to understand how the Old Testament applies to our lives, the Psalms, of course, have found wide use in both the church and private devotions. Many of our traditional hymns and praise choruses are either taken from or based upon passages from the Psalms. One book I have on hermeneutics subtitles its chapter on Psalms as Israel's Prayers and Ours. It is important to realize that not all Psalms, however, are to be understood or approached in the same way. Just as there are, as you know, different types of literature in the Bible, there are also different types of poetry. And this is especially true in the book of Psalms. So we want to take a quick look at the main one, at some of the main ones here. And again, this is kind of a quick look. Some are hymns. They begin with a call to worship and highlight reasons why God should be praised. Psalm 8 is a good example of this. Some are what we call laments, which have an entirely different mood. A lament is a cry in times of distress, and sinners run a particular complaint or complaints, perhaps even frustration with God himself. There are more than 60 of these. Some are individual laments on behalf of David, for instance, and some are corporate, as on behalf of Israel. We have thanksgiving psalms like Psalm 100 that we are all familiar with. Oftentimes, thanksgiving psalms are a response to a lament that has been answered, like Psalm 66. We also have what are called psalms of confidence or songs of trust. The person praying frequently expresses his trust, his faith in God's goodness and power. His confidence is God is present as he sings hymns of joy, Psalm 46, and as he mourns, as in Psalm 52. There are psalms of remembrance. These are quite popular, like 105 and 136. They make reference to great redemptive acts of the past, the Exodus, for instance, or the establishment of David's kingdom, or the covenant with Abraham, victory in certain battles, and so on. There are also wisdom psalms like 1 and 119. They contrast the foolishness of rejecting God's will or his word with the blessing of obeying the Lord. And finally, kingship psalms. And there are two types of these, those that focus on the human king of Israel, like Psalm 2, which calls upon God to bless him, and those that assert God as king of the earth, like Psalm 47. All right, now these are not necessarily hard fixed categories. Others may divide them up slightly differently, and there are often overlaps. A psalm could be both a thanksgiving and a psalm of remembrance, for example. One could be both a song of trust and a lament, and so forth. But this gives you a basic idea of the different genres we find, the general distinctions. And this is helpful so as to determine the intended mood, which contributes to not only our understanding of the prayer's purpose, but also why things are said the way that they are. Poetry, of course, is intensely emotional, and we need to know what the emotion is that is driving the psalm. Now, one genre you don't see on this list are imprecatory psalms, and that's because we don't have any psalms where calling down evil or curses on the enemy is the central theme or purpose. Rather, what we have are imprecatory statements scattered about in the different types of psalms. And most of the time, just about always, such imprecatory statements are found in the psalms of, who wants to take a guess? In the psalms of laments, okay, right. These cries of distress that call upon God to remedy some hardship, usually involving the oppression of an enemy. And in that lament, God is called upon to judge and or destroy that enemy, or perhaps pay him back for the wrong that he has committed. All right, so we want to take a look at some of these. We'll start with Psalm 3. Hopefully you brought your Bibles and you can turn there. Hopefully you can find the book of Psalms. There's that caustic sarcasm coming out. All right. As you turn there, let me make a couple comments about the historical context, the situation that prompted this psalm, Psalm 3. The subtitle reads, A Psalm of David When He Fled His Son Absalom. So this was written during a very low moment in David's life. Because of his sin with Bathsheba, all sorts of things were unraveling in his life. Not only did he have troubles in his own home, but his kingdom had been pulled away from his grasp by Absalom's rebellion. And as a result, David had fled Jerusalem and waited things out at a camp across the Jordan. This psalm reflects the national situation as well as his own personal feelings, and may have been written the night before a major battle was about to be fought. The opposition, of course, is very strong and the danger is very real. And so David writes, and follow along with me, verse 1 of Psalm 3. Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. But you, Lord, are a shield around me, my glory, the one who lifts my head high. I call out to the Lord, and he answers me from his holy mountain. I lie down and sleep. I awake again, because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear, though tens of thousands assail me on every side. Arise, Lord, deliver me, my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw, break the teeth of the wicked. May the Lord, from the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. I guess that's the end of it. All right, now on the surface, one might think that this is a lament, you know, kind of a complaint. But as you look at it more closely, it really is a song of confidence. David notes the threat of his foes, but conveys his faith in God and calls upon him for deliverance, which involves the crushing of those foes. It actually has kind of an upbeat feel to it, and it would probably be more popular in worship services today if it weren't for verse 7, quite frankly. The statement there in verse 7 is certainly imprecatory. Strike all my enemies on the jaw, break the teeth of the wicked. You know, we were to read that in a public worship service, and we'd feel real awkward about that. Like, can't we just skip that part? All right, let's go now to Psalm 10. This psalm deals with something something we call theodicy. And this is the problem of trying to reconcile the justice of God in the face of injustice. How can God be all powerful and all good and just when evil is allowed to flourish, or in this psalm, when evildoers are allowed to prosper? We don't know the specific situation here or even who wrote it, only that the psalmist is troubled by God's patience and doesn't understand God's patience. There are those who are taking advantage of the weak and helpless, and God is called upon to intervene and to do so without delay. I might note that years ago I often read this psalm while in front of abortion clinics. I think you'll see how well it fits that. And this was, at that time, the extent to which I personally felt comfortable in praying an imprecatory prayer. All right, verse 1, "Why, Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In his arrogance, the wicked man hunts down the weak who are caught in the schemes he devises. He boasts about the cravings of his heart. He blesses the greedy and reviles the Lord. In his pride, the wicked man does not seek him. In all his thoughts, there is no room for God. His ways are always prosperous. Your laws are rejected by him. He sneers at all his enemies. He says to himself, 'Nothing will ever shake me.' He swears, 'No one will ever do me harm.' His mouth is full of lies and threats. Trouble and evil are under his tongue. He lies in wait near the villages. From ambush, he murders the innocent. His eyes watch in secret for his victims. Like a lion in cover, he lies in wait. He lies in wait to catch the helpless. He catches the helpless and drags them off in his net. His victims are crushed. They collapse. They fall under his strength. He says to himself, 'God will never notice.' He covers his face and never sees. Arise, Lord, lift up your hand, O God. Do not forget the helpless. Why does the wicked man revile God? Why does he say to himself, 'He won't call me to account'? But you, God, see the trouble of the afflicted. You consider their grief and take it in hand. The victims commit themselves to you. You are the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked man. Call the evildoer to account for his wickedness that would not otherwise be found out. The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations will perish from his hand. You, Lord, hear the desire of the afflicted. You encourage them and you listen to their cry, defending the fatherless and the oppressed so that mere earthly mortals will never again strike terror." All right, well, the structure of the psalm goes something like this, pretty simple. You begin with the rule of the wicked, the prayer for deliverance, the rule of God, and then resolution. And that resolution involves the wrongdoer, the oppressor, being exposed for his wickedness, being held accountable for it, and brought down. Breaking the arm, there in verse 15, is probably a poetic way of asking God to disable him. And if that hurts, well, so be it. He deserves to feel some pain. All right, let's now move on to Psalm 69. And it begins, "For the director of music to the tune of lilies." And it's written of David. So as you're turning there, let me kind of little bit of background. This tells us that this is a song to be sung and not merely a poem. We do not know the setting, only that it involves David and his suffering. It is certainly a lament, for David cries out in his distress. He complains about a number of things, including God's inaction in his distress. And the point of contention has to do with David's enemies, of which he has no shortage of during his lifetime, as you know, both outside Israel and inside, even among his own countrymen. And this contention is expressed in some very harsh language, as you will see. Psalm 69, starting with verse 1. "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in the miry depths where there is no foothold. I have come into the deep waters. The floods engulf me. I am worn out calling for help. My throat is parched. My eyes fail looking for my God." Where are you? So let's just pause there for a moment. We have to note something here. I mean, this is pretty frank language. I don't know that you or I would ever feel comfortable praying this way, but David is frustrated that God isn't coming to his aid, and he feels free to express that complaint to God. And so one thing we do see in the Psalms is a certain kind of raw openness. And we kind of need to keep that in mind, this freedom to say what one feels. And here's a good example of that. And we should also keep in mind as we get further into the psalm here that this is poetry. We are going to expect figures of speech, including over-the-top language like exaggeration and hyperbole and so forth. And this will certainly apply to the imprecatory statements that are coming up. And we even see some hyperbole even here in verse 4. Those who hate me without reason outnumber the hairs on my head. Bit of a stretch. Many are my enemies without cause, those who seek to destroy me. I am forced to restore what I did not steal. You, God, know my folly. My guilt is not hidden from you. Lord the Almighty, may those who hope in you not be disgraced because of me. God of Israel, may those who seek you not be put to shame because of me. For I endure scorn for your sake, and shame covers my face. I am a foreigner to my own family, a stranger to my own mother's children. Probably a reference to Absalom. For zeal for your house consumes me, and the insults of those who insult you fall on me. When I weep and fast, I must endure scorn. When I put on sackcloth, people make sport of me. Those who sit at the gate mock me, and I am the song of the drunkards. But I pray to you, Lord, in the time of your favor and your great love, O God, answer me in your sure salvation. Rescue me from the mire. Do not let me sink. Deliver me from those who hate me, from the deep waters. Do not let the flood waters engulf me or the depths swallow me up or the pit close its mouth over me. Really sense the emotion here. Answer me, Lord, out of the goodness of your love and your great mercy toward me. Do not hide your face from your servant. Answer me quickly, for I am in trouble. Come near and rescue me. Deliver me because of my foes. You know how I am scorned, disgraced, and shamed. All my enemies are before you. Scorn has broken my heart and has left me helpless. I looked for sympathy, but there was none. For comforters, but I found none. They put gall in my food and gave me vinegar for my thirst. May the table set before them become a snare. May it become retribution and a trap. May their eyes be darkened so they cannot see and their backs be bent forever. Pour out your wrath, your rage on them. Let your fierce anger overtake them. May their place be deserted. Let there be no one to dwell in their tents. For they persecute those who wound and talk about the pain of those you hurt. Charge them with crime upon crime. Do not let them share in your salvation. May they be blotted out of the book of life and not be listed with the righteous. But as for me, afflicted and in pain, may your salvation, God, protect me. I will praise God's name in song and glorify him with thanksgiving. This will please the Lord, may then more than an ox, more than a bull with its horns and hooves. The poor will see and be glad. You who seek God, may your hearts live. The Lord hears the needy and does not despise his captive people. Let heaven and earth praise him, the seas and all that move in them. For God will save Zion and rebuild the cities of Judah. Then people will settle there and possess it. The children of his servants will inherit it, and those who love his name will dwell there. All right, long psalm, pretty intense stuff. Keep in mind that the psalm was intended to be sung. There are verses here that glorify God for his love and mercy, verses that express David's trust and confidence in the Lord, verses where he complains, and verses where David calls upon God to punish his enemies and to do so harshly. Try to keep in mind some of those particular statements as we work through this subject today and next week. All right, let's look at another one, Psalm 109. Like Psalm 69, this too is a psalm of lament, and it's very heavy on the imprecatory. And again, we do not know the setting, only that it involves David in a hardship he's going through. He cries out in distress. He complains about the wickedness of his enemies, and he calls upon God to punish them without mercy. And again, just notes how some of the language is quite harsh. So again, starting with verse 1 of Psalm 109, "My God, whom I praise, do not remain silent. For people who are wicked and deceitful have opened their mouths against me, for they have spoken against me with lying tongues. With words of hatred they surround me, they attack me without cause. In return for my friendship they accuse me, but I am a man of prayer. They repay evil for good and hatred for my friendship. Appoint someone evil to oppose my enemy. Let an accuser stand at his right hand. When he is tried, let him be found guilty, and may his prayers condemn him." The sense here, this is, you know, probably referring not to prayers to God, but supplications made to a human judge. And this is kind of like a double the sentence because he had the audacity to speak for lenience kind of thing before that judge. Verse 8, "May his days be few. May another take his place of leadership. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. May his children be wandering beggars. May they be driven from their ruined homes. May a creditor seize all he has. May strangers plunder the fruits of his labor. May no one extend kindness to him or take pity on his fatherless children. What a thing to say. May his descendants be cut off, their names blotted out from the next generation. May the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord. May the sin of his mother never be blotted out. May their sins always remain before the Lord, that he may blot out their names from the earth. For he never thought of doing a kindness, but hounded the deaf, but hounded to death the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted. He loved to pronounce a curse. May it come back on him. He found no pleasure in blessing. May it be far from him. He wore cursing as his garment. It entered his body like water, into the bones like oil. May it be like a cloak wrapped around him, like a belt tied forever around him. May this be the Lord's payment to my accusers, to those who speak evil of me. But you, sovereign Lord, help me for your name's sake. Out of the goodness of your love, deliver me, for I am poor and needy, and my heart is wounded within me. I fade away like an evening shadow. I am shaken off like a locust. My knees give way from fasting. My body is thin and gaunt. I am an object of scorn to my accusers. When they see me, they shake their heads. Help me, Lord, my God. Save me according to your unfailing love. Let them know that it is your hand, that you, Lord, have done it. While they curse, may you bless. May those who attack me be put to shame, but may your servant rejoice. May my accusers be clothed with disgrace and wrapped in shame as in a cloak. With my mouth I will greatly extol the Lord. In the great throng of worshipers I will praise him, for he stands at the right hand of the needy to save their lives from those who would condemn them. Pretty intense stuff. Sometimes we find imprecatory statements where we would least expect them. I'll mention two examples, each taken from Psalms that you are familiar with. One is Psalm 23, the most popular psalm of all time. Even those outside the faith who have no affiliation with the church, know it. It's a favorite at funerals. It's beautifully written. After the green pasture and waters of comfort and sure confidence in the valley of the shadow of death, we suddenly run across, "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies," which is another way of saying, when those I hate see how much you have blessed me, they will eat their heart out, and this brings me great delight. Another example is Psalm 139, which contains a passage that is often used to bolster the pro-life position. I mentioned this earlier in the year. David speaks of how God has knit us together in our mother's womb, fearfully and wonderfully made. There are several verses in that section, very descriptive, very beautiful, very powerful. And then he abruptly says, "If only you would slay the wicked, O God." After that great passage on the sanctity of life, he then says, "If only you would slay the wicked, O God." His train of thought seems to be, "Oh Lord, you do such wonderful things. Even the way you make us is so amazing. But if you wanted to do something really good, you would rid the earth of evildoers and these enemies of mine." In other psalms, we find a variety of statements where God is called upon to do things like consume the enemies with his wrath, to let them vanish like water that flows away, like a stillborn child, may they not see the sun, and that the God would make them go down into the grave alive, and that their babies would be smashed against the rocks, and more. The babies being smashed against the rocks comes from Psalm 137, and we will spend a fair amount of time on that next Sunday. So what do we make of this? Some important observations need to be noted. I'll mention two for today, and then we'll continue this with more next Sunday. I'll flash it up here in a minute. I didn't want to get ahead. Should have been a separate slide for each of those points. The first is that these psalms are addressed to God. This is a proper way to channel one's feelings, even feelings that are generally discouraged in Scripture. We all feel anger, okay? Even anger toward other people. You can't deny that. To deny that is to be self-deceived, just downright dishonest. And if we're going to feel anger, then it is best to express this to God, who knows that we feel this way anyway, and place the unjust situation in His hands and leave it there. Scriptures are quite clear that vengeance is His, not ours. Feeling anger is different than doing anger. It is much better to call upon God to make things right and use that as a way to vent our hurt than to take matters into our own hands, or for that matter, to harbor resentment and bitterness. Even in the Psalms, those who prayed such prayers did not execute them. They made their appeal to God. All right, we'll talk more about this next week. But again, one thing we do see in the Psalms is this raw openness, this freedom to say what one feels. And that can actually be quite therapeutic, you know, to read, to pray, and to sing, those sorts of statements we find in the Psalms. We can connect with the Psalms in expressing our emotions, both good ones and those that require some restraint. No matter how sad you are, there is a psalm to help you express that. The same is true with joy, with thanksgiving, and sorrow, and frustration, and anger, and this inward cry for vengeance. The psalmist held nothing back, and neither should we. Secondly, this is very important, we have to keep in mind God's intentions for ancient Israel. He had a unique purpose for them. This is a very important point here. And that purpose even affected the way they were to relate to other nations. And the Psalms reflect this. And it is not the same for us. You know, we have to read the Psalms with that understanding in mind. Again, Hermeneutics 101. For instance, we cannot think, as we typically do often, we cannot think of ancient Israel as an Old Testament church. Okay, they were a nation. And as a nation, they were to be separated from other nations. And these other nations often proved to be a threat to God's purposes for Israel and had to be driven back by force, or because of their evil, posed a threat to the human race itself. Okay? Now, there are many differences between Israel and the church, enough to occupy a whole sermon. Let's take the way that God illustrates his judgment of sin. Under the new covenant, we always look to the cross, Jesus suffering the wrath that you and I deserved. In the Old Covenant, God would sometimes illustrate this judgment against sin by what? By ordering his people to take up the sword against a wicked enemy, like the Canaanites. And sometimes God would punish Israel by letting other nations take up the sword against them. And so these imprecatory prayers of God's servants, calling upon the defeat of an enemy, were many times nothing less than the prayers, prayers calling for the success of God's plan, that this exercising of judgment against rampant wickedness would be successfully carried out. And this plan had more than one objective, to punish sin and to drive out an enemy from a particular land or to remove them as a potential threat. Because it was, of course, through the nation of Israel that the Messiah would come, and so measures had to be taken to ensure her survival. But this, of course, is different for Christians, for God's people in the New Covenant. The relationship we have with outsiders has radically changed, as well as our mission. Our charge is to persuade them, convert them, win them over to the gospel, not defeat them. For one, we have no enemy standing in the way of us obtaining God's promised land. Now, this is not to suggest that imprecatory psalms are not to be employed, but only to say that we cannot draw, this is the important point here, we cannot draw an exact parallel with the way that they were used in ancient Israel. There is a limit to how their prayers serve as our prayers. And so, that chapter title in the Hermeneutics book, The Psalms, Israel's Prayers and Ours, well, yes, in some ways, but not in every way. This can be illustrated by the whole prayer of Jabez fad that swept through many Christian circles 10 or 15 years ago. You know, most of us at the time rolled our eyes at this attempt to take that prayer and make it a model for modern Christians. And mocking that endeavor was justified, for that prayer was never intended to be universally applied like that. You know, it sold books and it made the author millions. But if this rule is true, that any prayer in the Old Testament is universal, then, you know, as Sean pointed out one time, then let's start with the prayer of Job. Let's make that the universal prayer. May the day I was born perish. Why didn't I die at birth? May darkness and gloom reclaim the day I was born. You know, of course that won't sell books, but to use the point, why not start with that one? Well, the same principle applies to the Psalms. Many of them do have a universal application and should be sung or prayed in public worship and used in private devotions. Others that are tightly connected to a specific situation, a historical event, would of course be limited. And again, I am not on this point suggesting that imprecatory psalms have no place in the prayers of a Christian. I'm saying that we can't lift them out of the historical and theological context of ancient Israel and just drop them blindly without any qualifiers into our own practice. Our situation is different. God's purpose for us is different. Our relationships with outsiders and with enemies are different. Our mission is different, and so on. You know, so just because David prayed for God to break the teeth of his enemies doesn't mean that you can pray the same for your pesky neighbor who lets his dog poop in your yard, you know? Especially that three-word profane prayer that hopefully nobody here ever uses. All right, well, on that pleasant note, we'll continue this next Sunday. Between now and then, I thought I had a homework slide. There we go. Between now and then, I'd like for you to read Psalm 69 and 109 that we read earlier, but I also want you to kind of work ahead and look at Psalm 137. We have a few more observations to make about imprecatory psalms, go with the two that I talked about today. Then we'll work through Psalm 137, and after that, we'll tackle the modern-day application. I really need two more Sundays to work all that out, but it doesn't really fit the schedule. We have Lord's Supper scheduled in 2 weeks. And I'm just not creative enough to make imprecatory praying a Lord's Supper theme, so we're going to have to kind of squeeze everything in next week. So at this time, let's stand while the musicians come and the children can come in.